This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. As Bloomington considers a citizen review board for police, the chief of a department that pioneered community policing says he's a big advocate for citizen review boards.
I think it is a tremendous positive. It provides our community members with the opportunity to participate in the decision-making process and the policy-making process.
Jeffrey Bleimeister is the police chief of Lincoln, Nebraska. He talks with GLT's John Norton. Judy Valente has the story of a Congolese family and their immigration journey. She talks with those in Bloomington Normal who helped the family find a home. And City Manager Mark Peterson is in the studio to talk about Uptown, cooperation with Bloomington, and a multi-sports complex. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's May 30th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The town of Normal, like many communities, is closely monitoring the health of its retail sector as online buying siphons sales tax funds. Mark Peterson is the town of Normal's second city manager, serving since 1998. Mark, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Great to be here, Mike.
We'll also touch on Uptown redevelopment, including the underpass and a new library, high-speed rail, and a multi-sports complex. But let's start by talking about retail, sales taxes, and the town's budget first. What's the town seeing as it concerns sales tax receipts? Where are we?
Well, Mike, it's a great question and an important one for all local governments, certainly Normal included. As you may know and others may know, sales tax revenue is a very critically important part of our financial plan. It is our largest and most important revenue source, and it's been good to us over the years. The retail sector in Normal, as is the case in Bloomington, has grown over the years, and that means that we've had good growth in our sales tax revenue, well above the rate of inflation, which has been helpful for us to continue to meet the various service demands that we have from the community. Unfortunately, that has changed, and it's we're not alone. Normal, Bloomington are experiencing the same thing that many other cities across the country are experiencing, and that's a contraction in the retail sector. And when I say retail sector, I'm talking about bricks and mortar retail. And I'll get back to that in a minute. But what we're seeing is that, at least in our community, we've seen several recently within the last year, several retailers announce they're closing their local stores. Many are part of a national brand strategy. It wasn't necessarily due to a specific issue within Bloomington Normal. This was a national problem. But frankly, I think retail throughout the country has gotten overbuilt. And of course, we are the Main Street retailers are competing every day against the online retailers.
Sure.
And that's the other retail sector that clearly is growing, continues to grow, and that erodes the success of the Main Street retailer or the bricks and mortar retailer.
What about capturing some of those local sales tax dollars from online sales? Is there a way to do that?
Well, there is, and there are some laws in place that help us a little bit, at least certainly the state of Illinois. Any online retailer that has a physical presence in Illinois is required to collect sales tax and remit that to the state of Illinois. The town then gets a small piece. We get 1% of that sales tax, but what we do not get is our local sales tax, and that's a significant loss to us. There is a bill that's been discussed in Congress called the Marketplace Fairness Act. In fact, Senator Durbin was one of the key sponsors of that in the Senate. The bill did pass the Senate, but has not been able to reach a vote in the House of Representatives. And the interesting thing, a number of online retailers, including Amazon, which is the biggest, have actually signed on in support of the bill. But unfortunately, it has not found the light. It's the light of day in Congress or in the House of Representatives. Leadership won't call it for a vote. And I think there would be some strong bipartisan support. All of our local legislators have pledged their support for that bill, and we just needed to get to a vote. But at this point, there's nothing scheduled, and the prospects don't look good.
Congress isn't doing much of anything right now.
Well, that's true, and that would allow, if it was passed, would allow us to capture those dollars and kind of level the playing field a little bit between the online retailers and the Main Street or the bricks and mortar retailers.
So receipts in the town of Normal flat to falling?
They're flat to falling. They're actually declining slightly, which we have not seen since 2009 during the height of the recession. Prior to that, I've been here 30 years and I don't ever remember sales tax declining. It was common to have increases annually from 4 to 8%. And so when we see that very critical revenue source decline, it gives us lots of concerns.
You called it one of the largest, one of the most important. Yeah. Just now you said critical. What the sales taxes go into the general revenue fund?
Right.
And then what sort of services are paid for through the general revenue fund?
Well, most basic services, police, fire, street maintenance, parks and rec, snow removal, most basic services that we provide are funded through the general fund, and the sales tax is by far the largest contributor to that fund.
So how do communities turn this around? It sounds like national retailers are having an issue. Is part of the answer focusing on local retailers, high-end customer service, people that you know, sort of like what's going on in Uptown Normal to a certain extent?
Well, I think there's no question that the one area of growth in the retail sector is what I commonly referred to as experiential retail. And it's not just transactional retail, like I go to a store and I buy a product. It's creating an experience for the shopper, for the individual. Uptown does that. You go to Uptown not necessarily as a destination to shop, but as a place you want to go and spend time. And while you're there, you walk through these really quaint, interesting shops, and you find things that may be not available online or you wouldn't know where to go look online. So I think more of those types of retail developments is where we want to focus our energy and attention going forward.
So land use might be one way to sort of fight the declining sales taxes with flat to falling sales taxes, not only limiting sprawl, but aiming toward more density, like with the Uptown redevelopment and focusing on retailers in those sorts of areas?
Well, I think land use is certainly part of the puzzle, part of the answer. I think looking at mixed uses where there's residential and retail and commercial, like Uptown, in close proximity, very walkable, that those are the retail areas that seem to be doing well. But I also think that municipal governments have to rethink their funding model to some degree. And we haven't done that yet, but we have to look beyond sales tax and look at other ways to fund basic city services. The other thing, of course, and many communities are facing this right now, they're cutting back. They're reducing service levels. I've mentioned in the past, I know cities that have quit plowing residential streets. I know cities that have turned their streetlights off. Cities that no longer mow some of their parkland. They just can't afford it. They've closed fire stations, and I think that's the other reality. Fortunately, we're not there yet, but if things continue, we will be faced with some of those very hard choices.
So what are the solutions on the revenue side?
Well, I think, we first of all, economic development, trying to create jobs and create bring consumers into the community. One of the issues that we deal with in Bloomington Normal, in addition to this national retail problem and the leakage of our local retail to online sales, is our number of employees in this community are dropping. We have fewer employees today than we had last year and the year before and so forth. That means there's fewer consumers. So it's kind of a double whammy for us locally. We've got to grow our economy. And I know that sounds kind of like a broken record. We hear that about the state of Illinois, but it's true. We have to grow the economy, bring people into the community, and then we should see some stabilization in our retail sales numbers. That will help, as well as looking at land use and trying to incent the right kind of development that's good for this community. It's a multi-headed dragon. It's going to take several different approaches. And those cities that are successful in addressing this issue will be the ones that survive this situation. Others will continue to cut services dramatically.
It seems to me that a subdivision with 100 people living in it would cost the city more and take longer to pay off than it would be bringing infrastructure and services like water and sewer to a single apartment building that has 100 people in it. So,
well,
more density might be part of the answer.
Well, absolutely.
And Uptown 2.0 has that.
And you're absolutely right. Subdivisions are cost centers. They don't, you know, certainly they're places for people to live and they're important in a community, but from a financial investment standpoint, they're losers to a municipality.
At what point do you think the town has to start making some hard decisions about mowing, you know, police or fire response times?
Well, we're starting to do that now. Now, we're certainly not compromising public safety. That is priority number one. But some of those other services that are considered non-essential, we're already starting to look at those and trim where we can. We also, this summer, we're going to be going to the council with some expense cuts to address the loss of money from the metro zone that we're going to have to begin absorbing next year. And that's, again, kind of a start of this process to look at what we can live without, some services that are nice but maybe not essential, and where we can save some money. And that process is underway.
The next budget will be voted on in March, right?
March of next year,
yeah.
Yes.
So when does staff start looking at the FY19 budget, or is that sort of a rolling process?
We typically start in June, so that's coming up. We're budgeting half of the year. So we start looking in June, and we are our operating departments are knee-deep in budget planning in August, and then it takes about 4 months to get that process completed, and we present our preliminary budget to the council in January of each year.
So could you put a word on the next Town of Normal budget, austere, lean?
Yes. Yes, both.
Both of those.
Austere and lean, and in fact, we'll be talking to the council probably this summer, maybe July or August, about some measures that we're going to be recommending to get this on their radar screen so they're prepared when that budget hits their desks in January.
What position do you think the Town of Normal would be in without Uptown development? Do you think you'd be further behind in terms of sales tax receipts?
No question.
Thinking about trying to create a center, a destination like Uptown.
No question about it. Certainly Uptown, there was a lot of upfront expense, but it has been an overwhelmingly successful economic development initiative. Aside from the quality of life component, it is an economic engine that will continue to generate commerce for years and years to come. In fact, it will expand. So there's no doubt that money that was invested, that public money, is going to yield a wonderful long-term return for all of the residents. So it's critically important to our where we are today, but more importantly to our future.
Is the town doing enough to tell that story? During the last political campaign, there was some discussion about the town's debt load and how much they've invested into Uptown and into other areas. Is the town doing enough to sort of promote what the benefits of that kind of development?
Probably not, Mike. And part of it is it's complicated stuff. And when you start talking about municipal finances, most people, their eyes glaze over, understandably so. But we've got to continue to try to find ways to communicate our story better than we have in the past. And we've got to keep trying it. You know, it's interesting when it comes to Uptown. I think people outside of our community appreciate what we've done more so than people that are here. Now, I don't mean to exaggerate it, but we hear from other communities that are just overwhelmed with what we've done. They covet what we've created here in Uptown Normal. And I think there are a lot of people here who appreciate it, but there are also a lot of critics who say, boy, spent a lot of money and it was really worth it. I believe that it was worth it, and certainly other communities around the country that we've talked to, they seem to believe it's worth it because they're trying to replicate our success in their own communities.
Some of that might be natural that you just sort of take it for granted because you see it every day.
Absolutely. So,
this is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy in the studio with Normal City Manager Mark Peterson. The soccer fields on Central Illinois Regional Airport land have a little more time, giving a little more time to those who want to develop a multi-sports complex. This project is being promoted by Katie Kim of the Kim Group, a developer working with landowner Dave Stark. If the Kim Group vision comes to fruition, the sports fields and the associated development could be worth $50 million, according to Kim. Has the town been asked to participate financially in any way in this project?
Not formally, but certainly we've been involved in informal conversations. I was at two meetings this morning on this very subject, and it's certainly exciting, but it's complicated. I think there's tremendous opportunities in youth sports, sports tourism in general. It is a growing industry, and it certainly provides a hedge against the swings of the national economy, recessions, if you will, and again, appears to be growing. And there are a number of communities that have focused their entire economic development strategy on youth sports. We've certainly done some of that here with Champion Fields and what Illinois State University has done with Redbird Arena and so forth. But I think we can do a lot more. So I think this is not only an opportunity to provide a fabulous facility for our own children in the community, but an opportunity to take advantage of this fastly growing youth sports or youth tourism industry. Unfortunately, it's going to take a big public investment, and that's the struggle. And is the timing right for that? And that's I know there are others that said absolutely it's right, that we need economic activity and economic development more than ever. But we also have financial challenges. Our sales tax are lagging, and so the elected officials that ultimately have to make this decision, it will be a difficult one, but an important one. But I'm really glad that the conversation is taking place.
This has been framed as a public-private partnership. Is it there yet? Is it a public-private partnership?
I wouldn't use that term. Certainly there are private folks involved, and I think it's creating opportunities for private investment, which is good. The actual multi-sport outdoor complex that we're talking about, we say soccer generically, but it would address a number of outdoor sports need, including rugby and lacrosse and
cricket,
and football
maybe,
and cricket. Yeah, absolutely. We want to make the tent as large as we can and serve a number of stakeholders, but that's largely going to be a public investment, probably to the tune of $20 to $30 million, which is a lot of money.
That's the public money.
That's the public money. But the idea is, what kind of a return will that generate for many years into the future? And we've got to nail some of those details down, but the conversation's certainly taking place, and I think we'll have some answers probably within the next 30 days or so.
A multi-sports complex is something that presumably Bloomington and Normal would work on together. After the failed discussion about shared sales taxes and then Bloomington pulling out of the Metro Zone tax agreement, how would you characterize relations between the two communities?
Oh, I would say frosty. We still talk with our neighbor, and we still do business. We have to. We're polite, we're cordial, but it certainly could be better. And I think Metro Zone has still left some wounds on the Normal side of the ledger, and maybe some on Bloomington as well, and given how Normal reacted. But it's going to take some time to heal those wounds, but we're working on it. We're still communicating. I know the mayors talk on a daily basis. I talk with my counterpart, David Hales, on a regular basis. We're trying to still work on things together, and we'll get through it, but it probably, I think the relationship could certainly be better, and I'm hopeful that it will get better.
Ward 1 Alderman, Bloomington Alderman Jamie Mathey, during Sound Ideas, said that council members and aldermen are once again discussing a shared sales tax agreement between the two communities. The shared sales tax agreement would have each community receiving about what it's getting now in sales taxes, but work toward eliminating the competition between the two communities for businesses relocating from one community to the other and getting abatements. It's also a way for the two communities to pull together to attract new businesses to the community. Do you still think the shared sales tax idea is a good one?
I think it's worthy of discussion. Absolutely it is. Whether at the end of the day we can work something out and it makes sense to both communities, that's a question mark. But certainly I think it's worthy of a conversation, and it sounds like maybe that's starting to happen. I do know that some alder persons from Bloomington are talking with council members from Normal on an individual basis, and I know that topic has come up. I wasn't part of those conversations. I don't know details, but I think there is some renewed interest in at least having some conversations about a shared sales tax program.
Is this a way, if the shared sales tax agreement moves forward, is this a way to put the Metro Zone issue in the rearview mirror once and for all?
Absolutely. I think that would end that issue if we were able to reach some agreement on shared sales tax, because it basically then would take kind of the metro zone concept and expand it to the entire community. I think it makes sense on the surface. Again, devil's in the details, and there's a lot of details that need to be worked out, but I certainly believe it's worthy of discussion.
And maybe more details than were in the metro zone agreement. A news release shortly after the metro zone fell apart called Bloomington demonstrably untrustworthy. Is there enough trust to enter into another agreement with the city?
Well, that's an issue, and I would say we would the agreement would have to be carefully crafted. But I think it could be done, and I think we're both trying to rebuild that trust. I think from Bloomington's perspective, there's a trust issue on their side as well. I acknowledge that's how they feel. So I think we've got some work to do on both sides of the aisle, but I think it's possible to get something done.
That's Town of Normal City Manager Mark Peterson. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is Sound Ideas. Let's talk about Uptown again. A lot going on there for nearly a decade. Let's start with the library. A lot of community involvement in what kind of library, what kind of uses the library might be used for, and whether it will meet a living building challenge. What about the challenge of paying for the library? Is there a cost estimate yet, and is there a revenue source identified?
Well, there's not a hard cost estimate, but I think the preliminary cost estimates keep going up every day, which is not surprising. And my guess is we'll have to trim the scope down a little bit before it actually goes to bid. But we're certainly, you know, it's an exciting project. I think it's great for the community. I'm a big fan of public libraries, and certainly I credit what our library board and library staff have been able to do with the existing facility, which is old and is lacking in many respects. So we're excited about designing a new library, and I think the cost will be in the $20 to $30 million range when it's all said and done. So we'll see. It's still, you know, a few years out, probably 3 or 4 at least. And again, some of that's dependent on the local economy and our revenue growth. And if things don't get better, we may have to delay it a little longer. But I think there's a commitment on the part of the council as well as the library board to get something done.
A bond issue perhaps to pay for it?
Oh, absolutely. It'll have to be borrowed money. We don't have that kind of money in the checking account. And that it's appropriate to bond issue. What we do have to do is with any bond issue, we have to identify a revenue source and how that's going to be, whether it's an existing revenue, when we do have some money in the court recently adopted 1% sales tax addition, or some new revenue source. I don't at this point foresee a new revenue source for this. I think we'll have to carve out money from our existing budget to get that a new facility built.
The library public input process seems strong. Lots of community input, lots of community meetings. Does this make a council decision any easier when it comes time to put money toward that project?
Oh, I think so. In elected officials everywhere, they listen to their constituents, and the more they hear from people that this is great, we want it, as opposed to, geez, no, it's a waste of money, or it's not the right time, or our current library is fine, those things make a difference. So I think a robust public process for something of this nature is critically important, and I think as this thing transitions to a decision point, the city council will be very attuned to what they're hearing from their constituents.
The consultants have weighed in on an underpass, choosing a robust connection between Uptown and Uptown 2.0 south of the tracks. Mayor Coos said no matter how important an underpass is to Uptown and Uptown 2.0, the town would likely never go it alone to pay for such a project. What are your thoughts?
I think he's right. Again, we've talked about a lot of things on the horizon, outdoor recreation fields and libraries.
A lot of competing priorities.
And the dollars just aren't there locally to do everything. So this is one that I believe we've got a really good shot of getting federal participation. And I think it's essential. I think we'll have to wait till that occurs. I think eventually it'll happen. Maybe later than sooner, but it also depends on what happens in Washington, D.C. with their budget. So we'll work on it, but I think the mayor's on the right track with that one. We really need federal support.
Is the public comment period still underway for that?
I think it just closed. I think it just closed a day or two ago.
And so, any idea how public comment is leaning at this point?
I think generally, from what I've seen so far, and I haven't seen all of it, the general comment was supportive of the underpass. And I believe, I've read the consultant's report. in my mind, it's pretty clear. That's the best alternative. Certainly, probably the most expensive, unfortunately. But for the long run, I believe it's the best. And I think most of the comments reached that same conclusion. But there were certainly others that felt maybe a do-nothing option was the right approach for us. So.
In that same area, boarding station, the new boarding station south of the tracks. What's the status of that, and when might we see people actually boarding trains from that set of tracks?
Well, it's done and it's ready to go. I think it just depends on the track work, and that's getting close. So I would say a late summer, early fall, maybe sooner than that, but I would say August, September. We should see trains coming in on that, what we call the South Track, that will use that renovated, the old, what we call the old Amshack, is now a very nice Amshack, and it will be a nice boarding facility for those coming on the South Track. But the work is all done, and it's just waiting for the passengers to arrive.
But so will passengers know in advance that they're going to be boarding from that side, or will they have to walk around, or do we even know yet?
We don't know. I wish we knew. You think that would be a pretty simple question, but we're getting conflicting information from the railroad and from Amtrak. It kind of changes every day, so we don't know.
So what's your understanding of the high-speed rail project between Bloomington, Normal, and Chicago? How far are we from 110-mile service from Normal to Chicagoland?
Well, there are certainly sections that are currently going 110 mile an hour and others that aren't, but I think they're making progress. I believe that the hope was to have most of the track work completed by the end of July, and I think it's a scramble to get that done, but I believe by August or September, we should be 110 miles an hour most of the way. There might be some small sections here or there where they have to slow down, but I think they'll be pretty close. Now, when you get into the city, there's some other conflicts with freight that have not yet been resolved. So then it slows down as you get into the urbanized area of Chicago. But between certainly Joliet and Bloomington Normal going north, I think most of that work will be done. South, I think the issue is Springfield still. Springfield has still got some issues. But that typically the trains don't go at a real high rate of speed through the city anyway, so that shouldn't create problems. But I would say hopefully by late summer, early fall, we'll be ready to go 110 miles an hour on most of that route.
Do you think there's a time in the future where Bloomington Normal could be thought of as a bedroom community for the Chicago area? People live here, work there, or vice versa?
Well, I think so. I think that's absolutely possible. I think it's also the opposite. People may live in Chicago and come to work down here at State Farm or Country or Illinois State. So I think that's a real possibility when you've got, if you're talking about, an hour and 20, hour and 40 minutes, that's a reasonable commute for a lot of people, not necessarily me, but a lot of people have that commute every day in the Chicagoland area, and they see probably Bloomington Normal is a really attractive place to live. Housing costs are lower, so I think it is a possibility.
Okay, Mark Peterson is the Town of Normal City Manager, marking your 20th anniversary next year, right?
That's right. Today, yeah, next February.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you.
Mark, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas. As always, we appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
A new family is moving to Bloomington that normally wouldn't be news, but members of this family are refugees from a devastating civil conflict in the African Republic of Congo. The family, a mother and two small children, spent 14 years in a refugee camp in Malawi and have been living temporarily in Chicago. Now, three local faith communities have joined together to provide a new home for them here. GLT's Judy Valente talked with three members of those faith communities. One of them, Gretchen Snow of Resurrection Lutheran Church, says people of faith simply had to act, and that Bloomington Normal is a community with ample resources to help.
Wanting to learn more about the Syrian situation, and we had a professor from Wesleyan, Mike Weiss, come and talk to us about the political aspect of things. And then they asked me to present about the refugees and the path the refugees were taking and the situation of being refugees and what did it take to come to the United States, the whole process. Which was done on a Sunday morning when candidate Trump was at the airfield across the path.
So about April of 2016, of last year.
Correct. So he was talking with people, and I was talking with people.
Now, is it true that originally you were thinking of a Syrian family, bringing a Syrian refugee family?
Well, and from this education time, we decided to pursue it some more. And I had become acquainted through Lutheran Immigration Refugee Services of Refugee One. Incredible supports for people coming in, educational, vocational. Businesses in Chicago have worked with Refugee One for years, providing work. And I mean, it's just a magnificent organization. And another member of the congregation had also learned about Refugee One. So we connected with them, and we started putting kits together for refugees coming in to the Chicago area. And they had a workshop that six of us attended. And again, it was 160 people from mosques, temples, and congregations and community groups. And that's where we just learned more about it. And so from that, as a congregation, we decided we wanted to attempt to be a part of supporting a refugee family. But the family would have to be in Chicago. And so we had to find someone to partner with. And so we had to sort of scurry together a meeting, and we invited Kim Snoddy from Refugee One to my home to have a meeting to teach us more people about Refugee One. So that's how it got started.
Mary Beth Taylor, your faith community, New Covenant Community Church, joined this effort. Were you still looking to bring a Syrian family?
Very recently, we had asked Refugee One if they would consider at some point letting us have a family in Bloomington. And then this Congolese family had been working with Refugee One for 2 years. They have been in the States 2 years. I believe that's right, isn't it, Gretchen? Mm-hmm. And they weren't going to be able to stay in the apartment they were in. And we had told Refugee One that there was a substantial Congolese community here in Bloomington Normal. And it just occurred to them we could send this family to Bloomington Normal if the group working on it down there, which involved three faith communities at that point and other community members, was interested in doing that.
So, Mary Campbell, you are involved in this effort, too, through your small faith group called the Sunday Evening Group. What about this Congolese family? Tell us a little bit about why they left the Congo, where they had been prior to coming to Chicago.
Parts of the Congo have been under extreme conflict for many, many years, decades probably. This family left and ended up in a refugee camp back in about 2003, I believe. And they have lived in the refugee camp since that time until 2 years ago when they arrived in Chicago as part of a refugee resettlement effort. Many of the Congolese who are in McLean County did not come as refugees. They came under other arrangement. But this woman has come through, this family has come through a refugee status. So for 2 years they've lived in Chicago, but they need more extensive support.
What exactly does that mean? Do you pay their rent? Who pays for their food? How are they going to support themselves? Mary Beth, did you want to answer that?
Yes, they will need some assistance from us, and they'll be getting some help from the government. The government does support to some degree, and they have a the family has a child who has substantial medical needs. The state Medicaid program will help pay for those. But then they will need some assistance for a time until she can find a job and they can become more self-supporting from the community here. And so we'll be helping with rent and other things that they will need.
So, Gretchen Snow, do people make a commitment to give a certain amount of money, or do they make a commitment to give furniture or other items?
Almost all, at this point, of the needs for the home itself have been provided by individuals donating it, providing all the furnishings and kitchen items and all the things you need to make a home have been donated. And then individuals have been donating through their faith group, or directly to Refugee One, and then that money will filter through to the family.
So, Mary Campbell, am I understanding correctly that someone has actually donated a house for the folks to live in, or?
No, it's housing, regular housing in the community. Subsidized housing is eventually the goal. The focus was to find a place where the mother could take care of the child with these extensive medical needs and an area that was near other members of the Congolese community so that the child and there's another individual, so there's mom and two children. So trying to make a place for them. So it's right in the community, and it's not a home. It's a one floor unit that will allow them to live there.
So who pays the rent then?
That's where the support will come in. Initially, the money that's been raised from the three communities and others throughout the community will help to subsidize what she's able to provide. She's able to get some assistance from the government, and then the rest will be able to be provided for a probably at least a two-year period through the faith communities until she can get the medical needs for her daughter taken care of, which will allow her to work more hours.
How can people in the community help you with this effort, even if they're not members of your own faith community? Mary Beth, did you want to answer that?
Yes. We certainly would welcome cash donations. Those will be very important in the years. And they can donate through New Covenant Community by writing a check to New Covenant Community and then put in the memo line refugee resettlement so that our bookkeeper knows exactly what's coming in, and any level of help would be appreciated. We will be working with food pantries in the area to help with food, and the schools have been very, we've already talked with the schools, they've been very supportive and welcoming. As well as the medical community has been very supportive and welcoming.
And I imagine people can write checks also to Resurrection Lutheran.
And also people could go directly to Refugee One's website, and there's a page for the Bloomington Normal Resettlement Committee, a group, and can go directly to there if people are more comfortable with that.
Well, I'd like to ask all three of you, we live in an age now where there's this tremendous pushback against refugees. You have some communities that say we don't want any refugees at all in our community. Gretchen?
Well, my faith tells me to reach out to those in need. So that's been a part of who I am, I guess. But also the Syrian crisis definitely is what brought it to forefront. It just seemed impossible not to be responding. And the people within RLC, and it's not everyone, but a large group, just felt the same way. We had to find a way to respond. It ended up not being to Syrians, but we also came to understand the numerous people coming to the United States from many difficult situations. And so our hearts were just open to being a part of welcoming.
Mary Beth?
Well, for me also, my core beliefs, Christian beliefs and teachings, I think, say that we reach out to people in need, that we are so fortunate. Also, I think it's just who our country really is and has been from the beginning. We've welcomed strangers and refugees and immigrants, mm-hmm. and they have made our country the country it is, and they make such contributions here. This woman is just a fantastic person.
Oh, incredible.
So resilient.
And the mother and the family.
Yes, yes.
And the children.
And the children, too. They're so resilient, and she'll bring a lot to this community.
Yeah.
And the children will, too.
Mary, your reasons?
I also think that a lot of us felt powerless, helpless, mm-hmm. when we saw the attack that was being put forth on individuals who were in refugee camps, on individuals who were trying to escape terrible, violent communities. I think we all felt pretty powerless and decided out of that mm-hmm. that the only way to get rid of being powerless is to do something. And so we also sort of started talking to each other and began to realize that as a community, we can do something. And it was this something that I think will make a difference. You know, that whole thing about the little boy that was throwing the fish, the starfish, out into the ocean. And the man asked why, and he said, because, you know, it helped that one. And I think if we help this one, we are at least beginning the journey of helping not only other refugees, but ourselves to be better people.
What would you say to other congregations? Would you say this is something you can do?
Absolutely.
It's just a wonderful community effort.
I was part of the resettlement of individuals from Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And
back in the 70s.
In the 70s, and many lived with us, and our lives were transformed because of their lives, and our country is better because they came. So it's a win-win.
Well, thank you very much for talking about this very important issue. You've been listening to Gretchen Snow and Mary Beth Taylor and Mary Campbell on the resettlement of a Congolese family soon to come to Bloomington Normal. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
The number of refugees, displaced persons, and asylum seekers has topped 60 million for the first time in modern history, according to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. The UN says an average of 24 people a minute are forced to flee their homes around the world because of violence or persecution. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Community groups, including Black Lives Matter of Bloomington Normal, the YWCA, the ACLU, NAACP, and Not in Our Town, are advocating for a citizen-led review board to monitor and weigh in on the actions of the Bloomington Police Department. In a joint statement earlier this month, the group said many residents, particularly in the minority community, lack confidence in current procedures for filing complaints against individual officers and in an investigative process conducted entirely by the police. Bloomington Police Chief Brendan Hefner has resisted the call for a board, saying citizens don't understand the intricacies of police work. But there are many citizen-led review boards across the country. One of the oldest is in Lincoln, Nebraska. The state's capital, with a population of just over 270,000, has had some aspect of a citizen-led police advisory board since the 1970s. GLT's John Norton talked with Lincoln's police chief, Jeffrey Bleimeister, who is an unabashed believer in the board.
I think it is a tremendous positive. It provides our community members with the opportunity to participate in the decision-making process and the policy-making process of our agency. It also provides a group that is reflective of the population that we serve with insight into our daily operations. In addition, it is an independent look outside of our employees who are paid by the city to analyze and look at, are we following the policies and procedures? Are we meeting the expectations of the citizens we serve, and in particular, the ones that are bringing forward a complaint? So I think these individuals have an independent mindset. They're very objective in looking at the fact patterns. They're asking the hard questions, and we're providing those answers. We're being responsive to that.
Who are the actual citizens that sit on this board, and is it citizens only?
It is citizens only. There is diversity on that particular panel, and that diversity is reflective of the population that we serve. There are business owners, there are retirees, there are defense counsel that volunteer for this. So they are either solicited through the mayor, not through the Lincoln Police Department, or they go online, they have a service mindset, and they want to participate in this. There's employees of large businesses in Lincoln. There are independent business owners that one of them is a bar owner downtown that interacts with our agency quite often. Another is a defense attorney. There is employees of the University of Nebraska. There is a lady that had recently retired as a very high-ranking member of the Human Resources Division of the University of Nebraska. So they all bring a collective expertise, a service mindset, and it's representative of Lincoln.
As how I understand it, citizens must contact the mayor's office in person to file a complaint, and it must be filed within 45 days from either the date of occurrence or essentially a court date that is pending. Now, from that initial complaint, how does that process play out after that?
The complaint is then processed by the mayor's staff. It is forwarded to our agency, to me, and then I assign, in all cases, an internal affairs investigation. Sometimes there's already been an internal affairs investigation completed, and so therefore we just add that to the existing investigation. The mayor's office then schedules, through the Citizens Police Advisory Board, two members to conduct the investigative process. There is a hearing scheduled. The hearing is scheduled where they will interview the complainant or complainants, and then they will interview all of the involved officers. They are tasked with preparing a report that they present to the General Assembly, to the entirety of the Citizens Police Advisory Board. It details whether or not we followed our policies and procedures, and then any recommendations that they may have if they feel that we have not, or if there needs to be a policy modification.
So if I have this right, the initial complaint is followed up by a couple of members of the Citizens Advisory Police Board and a couple of members of the police department, and they talk to the complainant. They also talk to the police officers involved.
Nope.
No?
Nope. That's independent. So we're conducting concurrent but completely separate and distinct investigations.
So the police and the advisory board members are not in the same room together talking to that person?
No, they are not. That is correct.
Okay. All right.
We're doing it on one side, and they're doing it on the other. Now, obviously, they need to interview the officers or the supervisors that are involved. And so both of them are being interviewed, one by IA, one by the Citizens Police Advisory Board.
Okay, so how does that process go from there? Those couple of people from the advisory board, do they go to the full board then and make their recommendation, and then they go to the police itself, or how does that work?
Yep. Yeah, we meet quarterly, and there's not always cases to discuss. Most times there are. And then that's when they present their findings.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. We're talking with the police chief of Lincoln, Nebraska, Jeff Bleimeister, and we're talking about the Citizen Police Advisory Board that they have in their town. There are some police departments that argue against the Citizen Review Board or Citizens Advisory Board because they say citizens don't understand what police go through. They don't understand police work. Have you found that to be a problem within your police department or with your review board or the advisory board?
No. In fact, we go to great measures where the majority of the Citizens Police Advisory Board members have participated in other decision-making processes on policies and procedures within our agency. So they have some insight there. We also make an invitation to our 10-week Citizens Academy, where it gives all citizens an opportunity who want to participate, a glimpse into all of the different divisions, what work we do, what current issues we are facing. I would say that it is so imperative that we have this outside participation, both as an opportunity to educate the public through these leaders in the community, and also to have the independent look, because they're bringing a collective expertise that they can apply what they've learned in their professional lives and their personal lives to this process.
Very interesting. So you don't view this as a necessary evil. You see this as a valuable tool.
Yeah. If we're debating wants and needs, this is a need. It is not a want.
Well, by definition, this is an advisory board. What kind of teeth does it have?
Therein lies the teeth is that this is a board that ultimately reports to the mayor, and the mayor's my boss. And the constituents of our community, the citizens of our community, are all of our bosses. And while they're only recommendations, they are recommendations made in a public forum, and if we would choose to ignore them, we have to be accountable to not only the CPAB members, the advisory board, but also to the press who comes to these quarterly meetings and to the citizen who is complaining themselves.
Well, you mentioned you've only been on the job less than a year now, and you view this as a valuable tool as a police chief. Did you
Absolutely.
View it that way a year ago when you started, or have you come to appreciate this more?
I've come to appreciate it more. I really have. There can be a knee-jerk reaction that says, this is another hurdle in trying to maintain a trust internally with our employees, but it's definitely not. It's just how you frame the conversation and frame the issue. As long as it's embedded within our culture, which it is, that we are responsive to the needs in every single forum, even if they are not happy with what happened, we need to take a look at it and have that oversight.
On your website, you mentioned that citizens are even involved in the promotions within the department, or at least in some respects. Can you give an example of a recent one?
Absolutely. We are currently in the midst of a promotional process for the rank of captain. At the Lincoln Police Department, we have the rank of officer, police sergeant, we have police captain, one assistant chief, and one police chief. So citizen involvement in that, in the captain's process, I reached out to members of our community. In fact, one of the oral panel that evaluated the captain's applicants is a member of the CPAB, the Citizens Police Advisory Board. So she participated in that component of the testing. Now, it's just one component, but their analysis, their rating of these candidates based on the questions that are posed in the oral panel carry tremendous weight. And we think that that is important because these are the people we're serving. They need to have a voice in that decision-making process. And that happened when I interviewed for this job. It doesn't happen at the police sergeant level because that's a much greater, there's many more, the testing process. And it's based on a multiple choice exam and a written analysis. But we're looking at ways to bring them, the citizens, into that and then also into our initial hiring process. We can't make it too arduous, but yet we want to give a voice.
Wow, this is fascinating.
But this captain's promotion thing, there was four members of the community. So four of the six members of the oral panel were from outside of our agency. They're citizens.
Lincoln, Nebraska Police Chief Jeff Bleimeister, thank you so much for your time. It's great to talk with you. I appreciate it.
John, you too, and have a great day.
Lincoln, Nebraska Police Chief Jeffrey Bleimeister speaking with GLT's John Norton about that Citizens Police Advisory Board. A number of Twin City community groups are advocating for a citizen-led Bloomington Police Board. The city is currently researching area communities that have implemented boards, including Urbana and Springfield. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.